of our students throughout the state, and there are several programs that we try to do, but I think this seminar is one of the best we have to offer for teachers. You probably know that in some counties we've been able to offer folk arts and education programs, and we're trying to build on those. As time allows, those are rather time intensive, and as time allows, we hope to serve every county in the state with that type of program as well. But at any rate, this morning, the program, well, for the next 2 days, the program on Native American culture, interpreting it in the schools, and especially dealing with the Seminole Indians, who are the most visible of Native American groups, American Indian groups in the state, is one that we've been excited about ever since Nancy suggested it for consideration as the topic this year. We were kind of apprehensive because it's a very, well, timely in some ways, but profound topic for us. Although there aren't very many Native Americans living in the state officially, I think there are far more than most people know about. And we were concerned at first whether the Seminoles would even want us to address their culture in a seminar like this. But after we began talking about the program and our friends from the Seminole tribe agreed that they would participate with us, we felt very fortunate. And then we learned that we could ask Raina Green from the Smithsonian Institution to be with us, and she would accept. The excitement just grew and grew. At any rate, the activities that we have scheduled for this next couple of days, I think Nancy and the staff have done an excellent job, and I know you're going to get an awful lot out of it. I hope you'll remember the summer seminar. Some of you may have been to summer seminars here before, and we intend to continue them. So if you find what you were looking for this weekend, we're already talking about doing children's folklore for next year. At any rate, I think it's more important this morning to get on with the program. I think we're actually a little ahead of schedule, but I know the more time we build in, the more opportunity for discussion there'll be, and I think that may be the most fruitful of all. So I'd like to take an opportunity now to introduce Raina Green. I've known Raina since we were both students. Actually, she had pretty much finished the program at Indiana University. But I met her there and was impressed several years ago with what a commanding presence she has, what a firm commitment she has to folklore. She's of Cherokee and German descent. She grew up in Texas and Oklahoma, but she's studied at Southern Methodist University. And as I said, at Indiana University, she has a PhD in American Studies and Folklore from Indiana University. She's taught at such prestigious universities as the University of Massachusetts, Yale, George Washington, and Dartmouth College. Her main work, it seems to me, though, is more in public service than university teaching. She has worked with the Smithsonian Institution and been head of institutes at institutions of higher education. And she is a very active consultant with Native groups all over the country. She, among other things, has been the president of the American Folklore Society, and I know her best. I guess the rest of us here in White Springs know her best as a folklorist. She's taught American folk and popular material culture, women's expressive culture, Native American women's culture. She has two recent books, Native American Women, A Contextual Bibliography, and another one, That's What She Said, Fiction and Poetry of Contemporary Native American Women. She has articles in such magazines and journals as Signs, The Massachusetts Review, Southern Exposure, Ms. Magazine, Corona, and the list is just too long to enumerate every single one. She is currently the director of the American Indian Program with the National Museum of American History. That's part of the Smithsonian Institution, of course. And they're developing a publications program there. They have intern programs. And she is concentrating these days on developing exhibits in small museums and working with educators, either in a museum setting or in schools. I know you're going to, after hearing from her, be just empowered to analyze every component of your curriculum and bring Native American culture to the classroom in a way that will excite your students and help them understand the people here in Florida who, well, for historical reasons, cultural reasons, may not feel as much a part of the mainstream, but are the mainstream and have historically been the people we call Americans. Raina, would you come up?
Water, coffee, everything. Nancy may not have told you, we had an exciting evening yesterday evening due to weather and traffic on the East Coast. We didn't get here till 3:30 in the morning, and so I don't need to speak directly there. So we had a lively one, and if I droop in the middle, I'll make you all get up and run around too. One thing I'd like to do, the first thing I want to do is thank the staff here. They've just been terrific in helping set this up. Nancy has just gone out of her way to make this easy, and for somebody who travels a lot, believe me, making things easy is really welcome, and I really appreciate that. And I just want to say thank you particularly to all of my fellow folklorists here who have done such an incredible job in Florida. We have a great admiration in the profession for what they've done here, and I think as a state you can really be assured that you're in good hands with this state group of folklorists, because they're really extraordinary. The second thing I want to do is get y'all to come closer and get in a little less linear pattern, because one of the things I want to do is get you just a little bit out of this straight line arrangement, because that's real Western, and we're not going to be real Western today. We're going to be real Indian. So let's try to just bring things around a little bit so I can really visit with you all and maybe sit on the table and all of those things. I guess we're going to need to preserve the taping system here so we can do that. I think y'all are just fine if we can just kind of ring around just a little more. I want to be able to see everybody. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get here so I can perch for a little bit. So you may want to get the tape recorder. Poor Jan. Trying to mic.
Oh, good. Somebody's already gotten on.
That's perfect. Going to commit this morning is one of the first things a principal years ago when I taught high school told me I simply could not do, and that's lean on the desk. And ever since he told me I couldn't do it, I take a real delight in doing it. I love to lean on the desk. I also quit wearing hose and a girdle that very same day. He told me, thank you. He told me that young lady teachers had to wear hose and girdles and not lean on the desk. And boy, I tell you, it was rebellion from the word go. So I know you'll all appreciate that. Anyway, so now that we've rebelled, we can get on with it. I guess one of the first things I want to talk about, and we'll talk about a lot of hard things today and tomorrow, because some of the things that really have to do with Indian people in this country are not easy. But there are other things that are really wonderful and they're really fun. So I want to convey a lot of things to you. But one of the first things I want to convey to you and talk with you about, and by the way, interrupt me if you can. work with me all during this. I don't want to just stand up here and lecture. I really want to be responsive to your concerns and your needs and to have some interaction between you all, because that's how this will really come out at the place where we want it to come. But one of the first things I want to convey to you is something that is really scary and hard to deal with and difficult to deal with and difficult to conceptualize about Indian people. And it's difficult to deal with in the context of schools or anyplace else. And that is that for most Native people, and I'm making a vast generalization here, and I'll try not to make too many of those vast generalizations because one of the things I do want to talk about is tribal diversity. But one of the things I do want to convey, and I think this is true of Native people everywhere, is that everything is sacred. Everything has to do with religious belief and power. And so the reason I say that that's scary and the reason I say that that's difficult is that you all know that the thing we deal with the worst in the schools, we certainly deal with it the worst in the museum context, is religion. And we have an enormous difficulty throughout this country, which supposedly was founded on the basis of religious freedom. We have the worst time in the world with dealing with religious diversity. And that's very painful for us. And it's very painful for schools, and it's very scary for schools. And as people face a growing awareness of real religious conflict in this country, because we're reaching the point where there is genuine conflict between people of various religious perspectives and various other perspectives, we are reaching a very painful time. And so one of the things that I think that studying and learning about Native people in this country can do for us is to help us get over some of that. Because I really do believe that American Indian people on the whole, and Native people all over this world, indigenous people, land-based people, people who have Native religions that they've had continuously for thousands of years, and I really am talking about a global perspective there, have an enormous amount to offer us in the way we deal with religion and the way we can deal with it if we'll only pay attention. So I'm hoping that maybe some of the things we can talk about today in terms of understanding the sacredness of everything will help us deal with some of the other religious issues that we have to deal with. So let me just try and work through a little bit of that. At the same time, the other thing I want to say is something that may be a surprise to everybody if you've never really been much around Indian people, is that things are funny. Indians laugh all the time. And that things ought to be funny. And so I want you to learn to laugh. And I want us to all learn to laugh together because the human condition is funny. And one of the first things that you're going to have to learn to laugh. If you can't, we're going to really have to work with you now. But one of the things that you will notice if you really are around Indian people is that far from what the stereotype pervades, which is the solemn, stoic Indian who never smiles, they laugh all the time, and they tease. So one of the things I'm going to do is brutalize you a little bit in an Indian fashion today. I'm going to tease you a little bit, and that, believe me, it's because I love you. I want you to work with us and work with Indian people, and I want you to do that, that I do that. Teasing is done pretty much among cousins and related people. So like most Indian people, what I want to do is just say that we're all relations here. And what that does, and that relates to a religious perspective, is that it puts us in a relationship. And that relationship puts us into obligation with one another. And it's that perspective that I think if we all learn to have, if we can all respect the obligations of that relationship, that we really are going to go forward and do extraordinary things and change some of the ways that we've dealt with Native people. And I hope change some of the ways that, in fact, we deal with people in the context of a school curriculum and education that really makes it hard on them and, in fact, ultimately makes it hard on you. But I want to make this easier. But back to the first point. And actually what I've done is done something that I want to talk about a lot, which is to stress the interrelatedness of all things. Nothing is separate from anything else in Native culture. And that's one of the things that I think is really important. It's not only that all things are sacred, and that, P.S., everything's funny, too. I'll talk a little bit about sacred clowns in a little while, and holy clowns, and I hope I can get you to be a little bit of a holy clown with me today, too, because that's real important. But that everything is related. I used to talk a lot with teachers who got so frustrated, particularly elementary school teachers and librarians and people who said, but we're expected to teach everything. Well, in most Native culture, the fact is, it's not that you're expected to know everything, and I want to come back to that point, but the fact is that everything is related. So take that opportunity of having to teach everything to really learn the relationships of things. So today, when I talk about Native culture, when I talk about teaching things, I'm really going to talk about a lot of things that may seem a little peripheral to some of you. If some of you stress primarily literature, and I end up talking about plants, believe me, we'll come back to literature, because it's a long way, it seems, from literature to plants just on the surface, but I guarantee you that they're really related. So I want to really, again, work together to create a context for the study and teaching and understanding of Native cultures that really stresses that point too. And on the first point, that is the point of religion, the fact that all things are sacred, I want to just say a couple things. I'm not going to do it this morning, but ordinarily, if I were really in an Indian event, and ordinarily if I were really in any kind of event, the first thing that I would have done would have been to pray. And that's always shocking to people in my federal agency, the government. You know, they say, oh, well, you know, we can't do that. And I say, well, I'll tell you what, that's okay. This is not an act of any specific religion, but it is an act, really, to give us all the blessing and strength that we need. And so whenever you're with Indian people, you'll notice that the first thing they do is pray. Now, I'm not urging you. Don't you go away and say, she said we should have prayer in the schools. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that before we do anything in this world, every act we do, whether it's making a basket or telling a story or singing a song, or making a piece of patchwork here in Florida, or before we do anything, before we dig a plant to use for medicine, before we do any act, there is a prayer that accompanies it. And it doesn't have to be an out loud prayer. It doesn't have to be led by anybody, because all people are in connection with what my folks particularly call the maker of breath. You can call it anything you want to. Native people will tolerate your calling it anything you want to, because they believe in everyone else's gods. And that's one of the first things I want to talk to you about. And I'll tell you a story. Once a long time ago, in the 18th century, a minister, a missionary, went out to some Delaware Indians. And this story has been recorded over and over in several different versions. Went out to some Delaware Indians, and it was the first time a missionary had been to them. And he asked that they allow him to tell them stories that were about his God, because he very much wanted to bring to them the story of his God. And so for days he told them the story of Genesis, and he told them many stories from the Old Testament, and then he told them the story of Jesus, and he told them stories from the New Testament. And they sat for three or more days, really interested. And at the end they said, well, we're grateful that you brought these wonderful stories to us, and we like these stories, and we'll believe these stories. We think they're marvelous stories. But we want to thank you for bringing us such wonderful stories, and so we'd like to tell you some. And so for another day, they told him their stories. And by the end of the half day, he was shocked. He was horrified. He said, I have brought you truth, and you've brought me heathen nonsense. You have told me scandalous things. This is disgusting. He said, how can you tell these lies? And one of the elders looked at him and said, we've heard your stories and we've appreciated them. We think they're beautiful stories. We'll believe in them. He said, why can you not hear our stories and think the same? So that's one of the first things that I really want to talk with you about, because Native people have this incredible appreciation of other people's culture. One of the first things I learned in a museum like the Smithsonian is that Indians want to come learn about other Indians. They love it when we have a display about somebody they don't know about. And that is just a revelation. I want to come back to something there later, too. I'm going to wind all these threads around throughout the morning. But they had an incredible appreciation of other people's religious beliefs. I think that if I can ever convince you of one thing that is absolutely critical to know about Native people that you need to know, is that they have enormous tolerance. and want to accept, and did in fact accept enormous diversity. They accepted Catholicism, they accepted Protestantism in various forms. Simply because there weren't Jewish missionaries, they didn't really have the opportunity to accept Judaism, but I guarantee you they would have. There would have been huge colonies of Indian Jews had Jews only been missionary spirited. They just simply weren't. But they accepted enormous diversity and at the same time wanted to do the one thing that no one allowed them to do, which was keep their own religions as well. And that is shocking in a country that prided itself on religious freedom. What happened to Indian people was that it was religious freedom only within a certain context. But if you could do anything in your lifetime in the context of teaching and educating not only yourself but children and parents in this country, one of the things that you might do is accept the two notions that, one, everything is sacred. Somebody asked me if they could go take pictures of, they were doing a book on American churches and they wanted to include some pictures of native churches. I said, where can I go to take pictures of native churches? I said, go take a picture of the sky. Go out and take a picture of the grass. Go take a picture of a tree, because everything all around us is sacred. And the second thing is that almost every religious belief and practice known to humankind would have been tolerated and accepted in most native cultures as long as everyone else's was allowed to live and thrive. And so American Indian religious belief, whatever its tribally specific version, needs to have the kind of support that it seems to me this country really is about. Because without that, nothing else in native culture survives, because everything has a religious base. There isn't a basket, a piece of patchwork, a song that exists that really isn't a prayer. And that's the thing that it really comes down to when I talk about Indian folk culture. We're not talking about folk culture. We're talking about a whole religious system within which it produces things like baskets, it produces things like songs, it produces things like dance, but it's all from a religious impulse. An old man said to me once, I said, why do you dance? Why do you dance? And he said, dancing is our way of giving thanks. Dancing is our way of expressing joy to the maker of breath. Dancing is a prayer. And that's the truth of it. If I never had one more thing to say, I'd want you to believe with me that every time you see Indian people dance or do something like that, what they're doing is praying. And that makes us have to approach this stuff with incredible reverence on the one hand. And that's where I want to talk about holy clowns and joking on the other. But laughing with things and enjoying it and expressing joy in it is a part of praying. It's a part of the religious act. And so when you see people dancing, when you see people doing what missionaries used to call this heathen, you know, this heathen nonsense, they are expressing great religious joy. My own folks still preserve what's called a stomp dance. Half of my family is Christian, and the other half remained in the old Cherokee way, the stomp dance way, which many people from the southeast still preserve, the Creeks and some Seminole-related groups, or some Creek-related groups like Seminoles and Choctaws and so forth, preserve the old dances, which we have done for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And half of my people, it used to be that the people who became Christian and the people who preserved the stomp dance, that is the religious ceremony of our people, didn't even talk to one another. They weren't allowed to talk. Well, mainly people who were Christian would not talk to the stomp dance people. Now we've come around full circle. I know that when I go home to Oklahoma that I will see some of the Cherokee Baptists. And boy, I tell you, we out-Baptist the Baptist at Cherokee. Listen, we learned it in the 18th century and we got it right. you'll never live till you've heard Amazing Grace sung in Cherokee, I'll tell you. But now they come to the stomp dances, and I think now there's a lot more openness, because they too realize that in order for Indian people to survive, they must keep those ways, because you can't split things out. You can't split things out. You can't sing the songs without accepting what goes with it. And what goes with it is this will to survive that is based in the premise of the sacredness of all things and the acceptance of native religious belief. So in order for folk culture to survive, and this is true of other people, I will guarantee you, it's not true of all people. Things have become separated out in many ways. But in order for Indian culture to survive and all those things that we all think are wonderful, those baskets, those songs, those dances and so forth, the religions have to survive and must thrive and be healthy. And they can do anything else they want. They can be Christian, they can be Muslim, they can be anything else. But the native religions have to thrive and be supported. So loving those things and loving the traditional ways means embracing the whole lot of it. It really does, because that's where it lives. And it is in that perspective that all things are sacred. It's really quite extraordinary how much that notion infuses native culture. It's just extraordinary. And how much, in recent years, it's come back. All over this country, what I see is an amazing resilience and strength of native cultures coming back. One of the things that's relative to that survival is language. One of the things that's really essential to that survival is language. A people's language is really the heart of the people. So when you see native language efforts springing up all over the country, and here I'll really reinforce that for other languages as well. And I'm not only talking about languages as separate languages, but I'm talking about regional dialect, regional speech. Language is what distinguishes the people in the rest of the world. When you have the Tower of Babel, you know, you've got all these different languages. And language is essential. Language is just essential. So language is a part of that. Language is a part of that cultural survival. And native languages are absolutely essential. The sound of that language gives people an enormous kind of strength. It gives people an enormous kind of support in knowing that they are distinct and separate. And that linguistic survival is really a part of that. And so language survival combined with religious survival, even revival if necessary, that is to restore it where it once was or restore it back as much as you possibly can, is critical. And so what we see is native communities all over this country trying to prop up and restore native languages, and that's just essential. One of the things we know, and I know there have been enormous controversies all over the country about language teaching, whether you teach Spanish first and English second, or whether you know what you do. Well, one of the things I'll tell you that should be sort of startling, and I know this for native people in this country, and it's just a little statistical fact. One of the things we know about academic survival, and it's contrary to what I think you'd expect, and it goes contrary to every stereotype you've ever been told about traditional people, and that is that traditional life is not a barrier to survival and success, even in very Western terms in this world. Lots of people think that tradition is a barrier to living on into the 20th and 21st century, but I will guarantee you that statistically, the native kids who have the highest rate of academic survival in this country are kids who are from traditional communities, kids who speak their language, kids who were raised by their grandparents in the old style, kids who have cultural resilience. So for you, as teachers, as librarians, as administrators, as people who care about the survival and health of your own students and of your own children and of your nieces and nephews, traditionality may be one key to that survival, and language survival is right out there. My students at Dartmouth, I've got a question here. My students at Dartmouth were really quite extraordinary. I would have predicted that the kids who had the most chance of survival in an atmosphere like Dartmouth were the kids who had been taken away at an early age and sent to prep school and who came to Dartmouth with a sense of what that world was like. And believe me, let me tell you, the Ivy League is a culture unto itself. I call it the chicken breast broccoli spear world. It's, people were issued 60 yards of tweed and a pair of skis at birth. And I used to think, I thought, my God, the only Indian kids who can survive this are little reptiles themselves. Well, was I wrong? Was I wrong? Some of my Indian students at Dartmouth are wearing little wasps on their jackets. They were suggesting that our mascot at Dartmouth, we had...